Our collective nightmare, a tourist in London noticed a man in a blazer and everything that was supposed to matter for the day. Kings, towers, ravens, vanished behind a gaze. The Tower of London, with its armor and ancient blood, performed the backdrop for a modern miracle. Two young strangers found each other while a pair of ceremonial royal bodyguards performed what modern institutions have stopped bothering to do. The Beefeaters nudged them together like functions of a bureaucracy that still remembers how to be human. She was an American student, visiting for a semester and barely remembering why she came. He was a Swedish college kid, polite and improbably well-dressed. The guards, red and ridiculous and anchored in another century, did the matchmaker thing that our news cycles no longer allow anyone to trust to anyone else. A grin here, a staged photo there, an old man with a white beard playing the instigator, and two people who might have walked past each other forever instead started a life. They crossed countries the way people used to cross oceans before every contact had a contract. Ferries and trains, cassette tapes sent across the Atlantic, Thanksgiving turkeys dried out in tiny dorm ovens, because that is the kind of romance the modern world can stomach. Unprofitable, inconvenient, and quietly stubborn. They decided to marry by a glacier, moved continents, survived dot-com layoffs, and a chapter of the century where towers fell, and everybody had to remember what mattered. They ended up raising a son who carries two languages and two holidays, and an attic full of tapes. It is small, ordinary victory against entropy. There is a grim poetry in the fact that a ritual guard corps, created to ration meat and parade pageantry, intervened more usefully than any of the policy rooms back home. The Beefeaters acted like a civic muscle we have atrophied. They matched two people who traded shoeboxes of recordings and literal stamps for connection, while entire systems around them became too busy to be tender. This is not a feel-good human interest piece packaged to distract from the real collapse. It is a quiet observation that things do still come together, in spite of the rot. A century's worth of cruelty lived within those stones, and still a ridiculous hat and an ancient custom produced something durable. The world remains a place where a comment from a stranger can set off a chain reaction that outlasts bubbles and wars and the steady erosion of institutions. They keep the Polaroids. They keep the tapes. On holiday, they give their kid two Christmases for the price of one and teach him words for calm in two tongues. The ruin around them keeps operating as always. People in power keep choosing the worst small thing and calling it progress. Meanwhile, under the tower's shadow, an absurd little human contingency plays out and lasts. This is a story about accidental kindness in a world that no longer trains people to do small, useful things. It is both consolation and indictment. It is proof that a life can still be stitched together from the leftovers. If an old man with a white beard and a red suit decides to step in, the nation that raised the woman in jeans will keep stumbling through better judgment. The Beefeaters will keep being unexpectedly competent. The couple will keep turning their attic boxes into a time machine when everything else insists there is no time left.
First world problems. Remember when losing a talent show meant you were done? Star Search lost the memo. It was the original Talent Factory, and also the original Mistake Machine. Britney, Justin, Aaliyah, Beyonce, all showed up, all got turned down, and now we complain like it's the show's fault the pop charts have trust issues. Imagine being the guy who beat Beyonce. That's bragging rights and a lifetime of awkward humility. I'm the only singer who beat Beyonce on national television, congratulations. You are also the human punchline to every story about judges being wrong. That clip ages like a participation trophy in a museum of humble brags. And when Beyonce repurposes that footage in a video and never replies to your DM, that's the new grievance economy. Offended by the silence of a goddess in your notifications, the reboot is Netflix's attempt to make nostalgia clickable again. Live voting, celebrity judges, and matchups that look like a late-night algorithm meltdown. Trapeze duo versus a woman dancing with her dog. That's not television. That's a carnival game where the prize is existential dread. We're outraged when a trapeze act knocks out a dog routine like we believe gravity should have a loyalty program. People talk about innocence like the original show was a quaint little talent incubator. Meanwhile, contestants who lose go on to sell millions, headline tours, and occasionally die very young. And the winner's immediate reward is a record deal and the faint memory of being packaged for a week of syndicated reruns. That's not irony. That's capitalism in sequins. And the judges? They hand out stars like they're doled out on Yelp. Chrissy Teigen gives you 3. Jelly Roll gives you a pity fist bump, Sarah. Michelle Geller gives you a look that says, "You were cute." The audience swipes to judge in real time because nothing says modern validation like mob-reviewed feelings. The real joke is that we treat televised rejection like destiny. We act surprised when a kid who got sent home becomes a legend, and equally surprised when a winner becomes a footnote. Our national pastime isn't creating stars. It's arguing online about who the show failed to see. First world problem indeed. Our biggest crisis is that a TV show that once judged futures now just supplies clips for celebrity mythology, and we still expect it to get the prophecy right.
President Trump is once again trading diplomacy for danger. After tentative back-channel messages between Washington and Tehran failed to produce anything resembling progress, the administration quietly moved from talking to planning. Options now on the table include airstrikes on nuclear sites, strikes aimed at Iranian leaders, and attacks on institutions tied to the regime. Negotiations are technically possible if Iran agrees to end uranium enrichment, curb ballistic missile range, and halt support for regional proxies. In practice, the terms read like an invitation to surrender. The choreography is familiar. A few weeks ago, the White House framed the same threats as moral support for protesters inside Iran. When those protests were met with bloody crackdowns, the U.S. considered military aid disguised as solidarity. Now the script has shifted to a clearer act, escalate until the comes to the table. The military is responding with theater precision moves. An aircraft carrier group inches closer. Patriot batteries and THAAD are deployed, and American airmen will run multi-day drills to prove they can disperse, operate, and generate combat sorties. In other words, practice for the worst while calling it readiness. The irony is not subtle. Trump's social media demands that Iran negotiate no nuclear weapons, while last summer's strikes already claim to have obliterated Iranian nuclear capability. Iran, for its part, is rebuilding deeper underground and has closed its doors to UN inspectors. Both sides now posture over a dead end. The US insists on missile range limits that Tehran refuses to discuss. Iran will only talk about its nuclear program. Preconditions for talks are presented as clarity, but they look more like self-imposed vetoes. Even on the question of regime change, certainty dissolves into absurdity. The president hints at replacing Iran's supreme leader, pointing to a supposedly weakened regime. In theory, removing Khamenei would be decisive. In reality, every successor is described as no less hardline, and no loyalist turncoat has materialized to do Washington's work for it. Allies in the Gulf have quietly declined to lend airspace, warning that complicity could make them targets, an inconvenient honesty in a neighborhood built on survival and calculation. The stated goal is a swift, conclusive strike that forces Tehran to accept U.S. terms and allows a quick victory lap. The record suggests otherwise. Deep bunkers, dispersed missile systems, proxy networks, and an Iranian military that learned from being attacked. Comparing a potential strike to last winter's operation in Venezuela only highlights the fantasy. Removing a dictator in a small theater looked neat on paper. Iran is messier, larger, and farther from the coast. So the machinery grinds forward. Threats, demands framed as diplomacy, military preparations, allies, refusals, and a president promising a tidy outcome. The human costs, recent protest deaths, regional civilians, soldiers on both sides, are visible but treated as collateral to a narrative that prefers decisive endings to messy realities. It is the same cycle played louder. Escalate until the other side blinks, or until no one is left who can. Either way, the next chapter promises the familiar taste of catastrophe dressed up as strategy.
This script is based on the article you provided, titled, "She Was Supposed to Be the First Teacher in Space." 40 years later, her mission continues. 40 years ago, America tried a small experiment in optimism. Put a teacher on a rocket and broadcast the dream to classrooms across the country. The idea was charming in a way only humans can be. If you can't conquer apathy, plaster the cosmos with lesson plans. Krista McAuliffe wanted to open the idea that space was for everybody. The universe, being the efficient, indifferent void it is, replied by ending the flight in 73 seconds. There is a peculiar human talent for turning catastrophe into curriculum. Families of the lost astronauts built simulated missions, lesson plans, and centers where kids do mock repairs and practice teamwork in air-conditioned rooms instead of vacuum. We named the nonprofit the Challenger Center, which sounds like a place where astronauts might have had coffee if the rocket hadn't chosen otherwise. Today, those centers have reached millions of students, sparking curiosity, building skill sets, and offering the comforting illusion that meaning can be manufactured like a factory output, one simulation at a time. That illusion is not entirely useless. Children who once asked, "How do astronauts use the bathroom?" now become the engineers who wire up the James Webb Space Telescope while wearing bunny suits and a delicate sort of awe. People who had to retake math eventually help build instruments that point back at the pillars of creation, asking the universe, as if anyone will answer, "What are you trying to tell us?" The reply comes in light years and silence. There's irony in the fact that the mission meant to make space feel inclusive ended by reminding us how exclusive reality can be. We hope to lift a teacher into orbit and lift a nation's imagination along with her. Instead, the mission's most enduring orbit is not around the moon, but around an idea. That human beings will not let an ending be final if it can be repurposed into purpose. Grief gets architected into programs, tragedy into outreach, absence into legacy. It's a tidy recycling of meaning, almost efficient enough to make the void look wasteful. The story also shows how odd courage is. It's not only in the one who climbs the ladder first, but in the ones who build ladders for the next climbers. Barbara Morgan, Dottie Metcalf Lindenberger, the engineers, the teachers who stayed, the parents who organized, all of them continued the original lesson by doing what humans do best after a shock. Collaborate, teach, and keep trying. Perhaps the last joke is that this persistence is both noble and small. We convert loss into programs, into simulators, into five-paragraph lesson plans. We create rights to inoculate children against despair with hands-on activities and team badges. Meanwhile, the cosmos keeps being vast and indifferent, offering up images like the pillars of creation for those who need something prettily incomprehensible to look at. So why does any of this matter? Maybe because the alternative is to admit that all meaning is accidental and walk away. Or maybe because, even if meaning is accidental, we still prefer the accidental that teaches a kid to be curious over the accidental that simply eats time. We launch rockets, run simulations, and answer kids' dumb questions about space toilets because the act of trying is itself a small, stubborn form of defiance. And if that seems insufficient next to the scale of everything, remember, the best we can do is keep teaching each other how to keep going. That's the mission that lasted 40 years. Not the rocket, not the footage, but the very human business of convincing other humans that there's something worth looking up for, even if the sky is mostly empty.
The capitalist fever dream Amazon trimmed 16,000 heads off its corporate hydra, a sequel to the 14,000 it cut months ago, and calls the body count a reorganization. 9% of its office staff evaporates from a company that employs hundreds of thousands and ranks second only to Walmart as America's private job machine. The language is clinical: reduce layers, increase ownership, remove bureaucracy. But the arithmetic is blunt: thousands of livelihoods exchanged for the illusion of speed. The ritual is familiar. Leadership preaches startup agility while running the logistics of a continent. Executives promise the cuts aren't about saving money. They are about efficiency, about making room for AI. The math is stranger for critics of conscience. Spend billions on compute and models, compress human capital to a fraction, then advertise strategic hiring in the very corners deemed future critical. Cut broadly, hire narrowly. Consolidate grocery brands by shuttering Amazon Fresh and Go and doubling down on Whole Foods. Centralized choice. Call it optimization. AI is the gospel on which the purge is justified. The CEO forecasts armies of agents that will remake work, allowing fewer humans to do some of the jobs being done today and more to do new jobs tomorrow. That tidy future is both boast and threat, a mechanized promise that efficiency will absolve the social consequences. Memo errors, layoff notices sent before the public announcement, expose the managerial theater beneath the rhetoric. A slip that reveals how disposable people have become in the choreography of corporate image control. Employees receive 90 days to hunt internally, or a severance lifeline if they don't. The window reads like a mercy performance. Enough, Time to search, not enough to matter. Reports and think tank caveats insist A, I hasn't wrecked the labor market wholesale yet. That yet is a promise investors like and workers fear. Some roles grow, others are quietly erased or automated away. Which workers will be reclassified as more efficient and which will be labeled redundant depends on line of sight profitability, not human need. This is not evolution, it is compression, consolidation of brands, centralization of capital, concentration of risk. The company that wants to operate like a startup while running a nation-sized supply chain is squeezing the human parts until they fit the spreadsheet. Every PR line about bureaucracy removal is a symptom, not a cure, of a system that values velocity and compute cycles over steady communities and predictable wages. The fever dream sustains itself on contradiction. Celebrate nimbleness, punish scale, preach invention, slash the inventors, fund hyper-expensive infrastructure, fire the people who made it useful. It is a market hymn sung over an empty factory floor. Efficiency as moral cover, progress as justification for disposability, and the quiet erosion of any social contract that once pretended employment was more than a ledger entry.